this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 12, and today I'm joined by Mark Munn, who is professor of ancient Greek history, Greek archaeology, and classics and ancient Mediterranean studies here at Penn State. His central research interest is in classical Athens and its political and intellectual history. His book, The School of Athens, Athens in the Age of Socrates, is, I would say, a stunning achievement, really, and an important resource for all of us intent on understanding Greek thinking in the context of the cultural and social history in which it is articulated. He's also the author of two other books, The Defense of Attica, the Dema Wall, and the Boeotian War of 378 to 375 BC from California Press in 1993, and The Mother of the Gods, Athens and the Tyranny of Asia, a study of sovereignty in ancient religion, University of California Press 2006. And I won't go into all the other articles and things that you have written, but we will post your CV and things on the blog. It's really a great pleasure to welcome you, Mark, to The Digital Dialogue.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. So what I'd like to talk a little bit about is, I know you're working on a new project, a project that has to do with the relationship between Eros and the emergence of democracy and what happens to democracy also in classical Athens. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that project and as a way of getting us started.
Yeah, gladly. Well, I'm working on a project which is at this point provisionally entitled The Power of Desire and Desire of Power in Classical Athens, but Eros and democracy are the focus of that. And it is an investigation of the question, what was it that Pericles and his circle, who were advancing the program of democracy, thought was the basis of this? What was the intellectual justification for putting sovereign power in the hands of the great masses? And for a variety of reasons, maybe my past interest in the subject of Eros as it intersects with different political figures in late 5th century history, it emerges in my mind that Eros is a very thematic program in the Periclean period. In all sorts of ways, in rhetoric, in art, in literature. And obviously, we see that reflected in the Socratic corpus, the Platonic corpus, and Xenophon. And so I'm trying to both explain the origins of this and to contextualize Eros in a way that I think it hasn't been done. It's often been approached from an art historical or literary point of view, from a philosophical
right.
point of view.
Right.
But I'm very interested in how all of these interact with each other in context.
Well, I've had the privilege of at least reading some parts of your proposal, not only the part that you just sent me, but also for the Institute for the Arts and Humanities, which I know you received a grant to work on this. So I have some familiarity. And one of the exciting things about, I think, from my perspective about the project, is that you are bringing these diverse kinds of texts, and be they architectural texts or literary texts, philosophical texts, to bear on the question, how do you see those things sort of relating, namely, let's say, the dramatic side, the what's going on in drama, in the philosophical expression, and then in the artistic ones in terms of your work on the Parthenon and other things. I mean, it's clear that you're clearly drawing on this passage from Thucydides, where Thucydides tells of Pericles, who says, you know, look to the city as a lover.
Right. Yes, become Erastai of Athens.
Right.
To expand on that, I'm looking at Eros as widely as it can be construed, and certainly in that passage there is there's an erotic metaphor which can be understood as a sexual metaphor if you personify the city or its power, the object of erotic desire there, as what Pericles is referring to. It can be understood as signified in sexual dimensions. But eros, in its broadest sense, is simply desire. And so what we're finding, what I see is the construction of desirable things, mm-hmm. Both in terms of the visual appeal of the city, the appeal of participation in democratic politics, mm-hmm. Because you can say that agonistic or eristic politics have an erotic aspect, mm-hmm. Not necessarily a sexual aspect, sure. but an aspect that's powered by the ineffable instinct to get into something that is irresistible, in the sense that mm-hmm. that people's well-being is improved or diminished by participating mm-hmm. in that. And it's competitive. Right. And this is a theme I know that you're interested yeah. in talking about too, the agonistic aspect of politics, and the erotics of that is the erotics of the success, the feeling of success in the approval of the
right.
crowd,
right.
And the avoidance of shame before the crowd.
Right. So this really is going to get to a lot of the issues that I think have been critical to me as I begin to try to make some sense of what Socrates in the Platonic Dialogues is doing from the perspective of politics. What kind of politics is this dramatic figure practicing, which is really the thing that I'm interested in, and how might that teach us something about how to practice mm-hmm. politics and even now with one another. But to bring it to the larger question, which is or point, which is, I think it's not just that eros is about desire. It is, as you point out, a kind of desire for something, and this something may be in a certain sense ineffable, is in a certain sense eludes articulation. But one of the critical things, I think, for Socrates, at least as depicted in the dialogues, is that desire has to be oriented as something like the good
right.
and the beautiful and the just, whereas if that desire is oriented just toward the approval of the crowd, or, and this relates to the agonistic dimension that you're mentioning, or to winning,
right.
which, of course, Socrates continues to bring up with the people I couldn't care less if I win or lose, at least he says,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd just as well be refuted if it gets us closer to the truth. So I wonder how you see that playing out
yeah.
in terms of the Greek democratic culture. Is it really, does this agonistic side really dominate so much that something else isn't possible? And to what degree does the agonistic close off possibilities of political dialogue?
Right. Well, the free radical in here, I think, is the notion of tokalon,
mm-hmm.
the beautiful,
right.
the good,
right.
whatever deserves approval and is desirable, and it's obviously a word and a concept that is context dependent in terms of what it defines,
right.
but it is applicable in situations of formal contest, in athletic contests, where the strength or skill of an athlete is kalon,
mm-hmm.
and the prize that the athlete wins for victory is a kalon thing.
Right.
But we find, you know, a century before Socrates, Xenophanes calling into question the value of this form of excellence or tokalon in athletics, and saying uh-huh. that people invest, and even cities invest great efforts at celebrating their athletic victors, but what is that worth, to paraphrase him very loosely here, because
mm-hmm.
I haven't looked at my Xenophanes recently,
right.
It's not worth the advice of a wise man.
Mm-hmm.
And so already there we see a kind of attention that I think right. Socrates is fitting into, where there's a large popular perception of what is kalon that is played upon by politicians,
right.
And obviously Pericles is a prime one of them who does this in his beautification of the city in all sorts of ways,
mm-hmm.
and promotion of the arts and,
right.
and drama in Athens. That's all part of what makes Athens a Calon, a place where the Torcalon is prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Even today, we'd say, right?
I mean, exactly.
The ruins and all that, right?
Exactly, and Plutarch marveling at it 500 years after Heracles. But the opening to question what is ultimately the measure of Torcalon,
right,
has always been there, and I think that's the space into which Socrates moves,
mm-hmm,
and begins to point up some of the shallowness of that,
right,
popular perception.
So, I mean, I wonder how that then works in terms of that moving into that space of how the Torcalon gets determined. Because one of the things that I always see Socrates is driving us to give an account of the good, but he never, at least in the Platonic dialogues, claims that he has. He,
mm-hmm,
possesses an,
mm-hmm,
account. So he doesn't operate with a determinate conception of the good. His interest is turning us toward it.
Right.
And my intuition is that he's convinced that in the process of turning us, we're already on the move toward it in a positive way. But that
mm-hmm,
also opens up the space for the misuse or the turning toward what seems good or what is pleasurable in the moment or what is good appearing at the moment but not really ultimately good.
Right.
So there's a space there where,
right,
that's open that I think is really critical for the thinking through of how politics operates with
right,
in relation to the beautiful, to Torcalon.
And an example of erotic politics or Torcalon would be the rhetoric of Gorgias,
yeah,
which is described to us in various sources as a dazzling epiphany to the Athenians when Gorgias came to Athens.
Right.
And his rhetoric electrified Athenian audiences and got them wanting to learn how to imitate it. And, of course, Gorgias was able to parlay that into a successful and profitable career as a teacher.
Right.
And there is an example, I think, of the Socratic method that you allude to, is that Socrates comes to, or we see through Plato and Xenophon, Socrates in the company of these popular standards of what is beautiful and desirable,
mm-hmm,
in this case the rhetoric of Gorgias,
right,
and so he of course asks him to expound on what is the core of this excellence,
right,
and then finds the problems or the weaknesses in those arguments.
Right.
So he proceeds from the popular to a deeper level.
Right. So then what? So how is it that you're conceiving what Pericles was up to,
mm-hmm,
and maybe even with him Protagoras and others around his circle,
right,
in Athens at the time, with regard to the question of Torcalon? Clearly, let me ask it really as a question. He is animated politically, and this is partly what animates the construction of the Acropolis and all of the beautiful things that are created there.
Mm-hmm.
Pericles thinks of this as part of an overarching political strategy of some kind, of turning us toward a certain,
right,
conception of the beautiful. Now, is it your impression that Pericles has this very politically instrumental conception of the beautiful?
Well, we never find it explicitly stated in quite those terms. It's obviously implicit in that famous passage in Thucydides's Periclean funeral oration,
right,
that you referred to,
right,
where he calls upon his audience, which is,
right,
not just Athenians, to gaze upon the power of Athens and become its lovers.
Right.
And that's certainly instrumental. But what I see is that both this rhetorical theme and its manifestation in various other media is so prevalent in specifically this period that,
mm-hmm,
it must have been something that people were talking about in explicitly those terms,
mm-hmm,
and saying, as for instance, remember the name of Pericles' advisor here. Maybe you can help me. I'm sorry that I'm drawing a blank.
But not Protagoras.
Not Protagoras, but both Aristotle and possibly Plutarch make reference to a man who wrote a treatise on music, among other things,
uh-huh,
and the ability of music to command the attention of people and command people's actions even.
Right.
And so we know that there were intellectuals looking at the mass effects of
right.
of public media of this nature. And in terms of the thematic presence of Eros, Eros is figured as a divinity for the first time in large-scale public monuments in the sculptures of the Parthenon in the company of the other 12 Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been an a thematic figure that's appeared in separate scenes or in the company of Aphrodite separately in mm-hmm. vase painting or in minor arts. But for the first time in public sculpture, assemblies of the Olympians, both at the birth of Athena on the east pediment of the Parthenon or at the end of the Parthenon frieze where the Athenians are approaching the assembly of gods in their Panathenaic sacrifice. Aphrodite, with Eros leaning on her lap, is at the very head of that procession in front of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And Eros appears in other sculptures there in scenes of Menelaus's reconciliation with Helen.
Right.
And other such monuments on the Acropolis, both the Temple of Athena Nike and other parts of the Parthenon. And this is unparalleled. It it hasn't happened before. It's occasionally echoed in later centuries. There's a famous painting of Eros in the Temple of Asclepius at Epidaurus a half a century later.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this is an after effect of mm-hmm. elevating Eros in a way that we see in Plato's Symposium, where
right.
the gathering there is to praise Eros in a way that he's never been praised before.
Right.
Which is a little surprising considering that he's already there in Hesiod
right.
and
right.
has been around in one form or another, but never celebrated in this public way. So the symposium and that focus on Eros that takes place in that dialogue, I take to be an accurate reflection of a contemporary
mm-hmm.
Interest in this as a serious and important subject.
Right.
Of which only certain dimensions are explored in the symposium.
In this, yeah, right. And I mean, that actually maybe opens up this whole question of how Eros itself was conceived. Obviously, there are many. Pausanias' speech tells a whole story, as does all of the speeches tell a different kind of story. But when Socrates has Diotima explain that Eros has this positive dimension of resource and this negative dimension of poverty, this poros
mm-hmm.
and paneia, that gets at some of the things I know you were emphasizing about the positive and negative side of Eros. I wonder if we could think a little bit about that as it relates to, let's say, even how Pericles might have been, you know, using it, you know,
yes.
appealing to it, because my sense, and I haven't heard the argument fully, but
mm-hmm.
in the outline that you provided, you have a kind of thesis and a kind of claim that it was really a certain kind of an Eros, or maybe even Eros gone wrong in a certain kind of way, that led to the destruction of the Athenian Empire and then ultimately perhaps of Athenian democracy, the demise of both of those sort of institutions in a certain way.
Right.
Right? Or that it, so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And
Yeah. Well, let's put that in the context by also bringing in the metaphor of Athens as a tyrannical city that also appears in Periclean rhetoric. And the theme of Eros and tyranny is something that also resonates in Plato and Xenophon's Socratic writings.
And always, I think, probably even at its origins, wrapped up with in an erotic context with the I'm thinking of the Aristogeiton and that
mm-hmm.
whole story of, you know,
yes.
of these you know, erotic situation that's gone awry in this sort
yes.
of, you know.
Yes. That, well, that's a further complication
right.
of this, because it's the anti-tyrannical
right.
message that Harmodius and Aristogeiton represent.
Right.
But in fact, just to digress on that
sure.
briefly for a moment, I'm convinced by the argument that I've seen others make, that the eroticism of Harmodius and Aristogiton, the theme that is picked up in Thucydides, is right. something that really develops in the later 5th century. It's not necessarily there. It's certainly not in Herodotus, and it's not in the early references, the Attic Scholia, that celebrate Harmodius and Aristogiton. But they have become erotic figures, sexual partners, right. even in the right. By the late 5th century.
As and part of this legitimation process of yes. that event. Right?
I think that just is a reflection of how prevalent the theme of Eros as a motivator.
Sure.
And in this case, they are a motivator for the highest good of liberating the city from tyranny.
Right.
But ironically, at the very same time that this is going on, Pericles is telling the Athenians, with apparently no shame, that they have become a tyrannical city,
mm-hmm.
And that it's dangerous for them to let go of this power.
Right.
And Aristophanes makes light of the same theme, that Athens, the demos, is a tyrant.
Right.
Again, maybe with some irony in that, but mm-hmm. but with not a lot of shame in the way that we find Plato. Well, for the most part, Plato and certainly Aristotle stigmatizing tyranny as rule gone completely bad.
Right.
But there's still a notion that rule for rulership's sake, the ability to satisfy one's appetites, the kind of argument right. that you find Callicles making in the Gorgias,
right.
is a good, that it is a desirable, it is a motive that should be encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Callicles serves very well, I think, as this, I would say, maybe post-Periclean erotic man,
mm-hmm.
who defends the argument that the gratification of Eros is the ultimate good
mm-hmm.
In the end. And so
do you take that as reflecting almost a kind of the state of Athenian democracy after Pericles, that this sort of articulates this just
yes.
complete hedonism, this complete...
Well,
if hedonism
it's still,
is the right word.
No, it is
yeah.
it is the right word, but just recognizing that Eros and the objects of Eros are well, pleasures of all sorts, including pleasures of the mind, but,
sure.
but pleasures of the body, pleasures of food.
Right.
Yes, I mean, the other character to bring into this, of course, is the personality of Alcibiades,
right.
who acts this out in the most dramatic ways publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And is the object of erotic desire. I mean, he's the cheerleader for
right.
for this.
Right.
And so in that sense, I see the Periclean project carried out under Alcibiades in that generation
mm-hmm.
as still being the driving force or a way of understanding the driving force of an imperial democracy that seeks to become ever larger, to embrace and include larger portions of the world. Not only in a consuming sense, but also in the sense of making the city itself irresistible to those around them, so that everyone else wants to become part of this wonderful city.
So then, I mean, so that too. So one can see that as an erotic drive to the maximization, grandeur, all of these kinds of things that could animate tyranny and empire and even a democracy gone wrong, right?
It goes wrong only in the context of losing the war. I should emphasize that. And
sure.
I think that that's, I mean, the Socratic Platonic critique of democracy is spelled out in Plato and the... in the post-Periclean period,
right.
in the full knowledge that this has gone seriously awry
right.
and that Athens has failed in that project.
But I mean, just to go back to, let's say, to the symposium, to Plato's symposium, and how Alcibiades, the character, is presented there in his relationship to Socrates, there's a way in which that dialogue depicts the failure as a failure of Alcibiades to come to an understanding of what Socrates was trying to get him to understand,
mm-hmm.
The proper orientation toward the good and the beautiful, which he seems in some ways to be on the way toward because he desires Socrates
mm-hmm.
in the symposium, which is at least means that he's perhaps moved beyond a sort of purely physicalistic conception of what beauty might be. But that also opens up other possible dangers, it seems, if we then put Alcibiades, the historical figure, into the context in which Plato has placed him in the symposium, because this is all happening just before the Sicilian expedition. And in a certain way, you could see what's going on as a real indictment of Socrates' failure to teach Alcibiades the proper way of orienting himself toward the good.
Yes. Well, I take that point as the irony of the dramatic date of that dialogue is doubtlessly significant in Plato's choice to elaborate that and present it in that way. What more can one say about that, except that Alcibiades is a character who is interested in pursuing what is desirable, not only in the way that Socrates sees the good, but also in the way that it has been constructed as a mass appeal.
Right.
And he's not going to sacrifice his public standing for Socrates' priorities.
Well, I guess my interest in that moment is not only to understand, as you articulate so well, I think, the positive and negative side of Eros, that it can be used in the way Alcibiades, I think, uses it to gain glory and fail to gain glory and maximize empire and all of that. But that it might have another possibility that I think Socrates is asking us to think about. And so what does that mean for politics if part of what Socrates is doing is being political by trying to turn Alcibiades' soul toward a different understanding maybe of the good, even as Socrates himself is unwilling to articulate a definitive account of what the good is. It seems to me that the critique in part of Alcibiades' politics, and even if we want to associate that also with Pericles, is that it doesn't ask explicitly about, well, what is the direction toward which this desire is moving us?
Right.
Is it just about, you know, increase of power?
Exactly.
You know?
And with that very point in mind, I think it's appropriate to think of the dramatic date of the dialogue in relationship to when the dialogue was likely composed in the early decades of the 4th century, which is a period in which Athens had been again briefly engaged in an imperial venture, when the son of Alcibiades was again a political figure of some controversy, but was a political failure, largely because of the reaction against the memory of his father. And I think that the symposium in that sense should be seen as a protreptic towards a new configuration of the appropriate objects of desire in a more reflective sense and moving away from the unbridled gratification of imperial desires of an imperial city. So that's definitely the direction in which Plato is moving there. In fact, we can follow that right on down to the end of the Platonic corpus. I've been looking at the Laws recently, and it's striking there that Plato has constructed a city which is essentially self-contained in terms of its desires, and the object of desire is turned internally towards obedience to the laws, and that the city itself is not to be open to outside influences or temptations in a way that is almost the antithesis of Imperial Athens of 50 years earlier.
And I mean, you have something similar, depending on how one reads the Republic, is it obviously a big, you have something similar articulated there. But I wonder if, it does seem to me that there's some significance in the fact that Plato doesn't put those words in the mouth of Socrates in that dialogue.
Right.
This is an Athenian stranger, and I'm open to various interpretations of that. But I wonder if it opens up a space then for us to think about maybe a difference between Platonic politics and the kind of politics he depicts Socrates as performing in the dialogues. And part of the reason why I'm interested in focusing on the dramatic Socrates as he encounters others in the dialogues is because it seems to me that you want to retain something of the imperial Athenian commitment to openness, commitment to being able to say what you need to say, paraseia, and all these other sort of virtues that I think we want to, I would like to affirm. So I hope an answer to getting, as you call it, a kind of encratic city, a city that is in some control of its erotic desires, is not about shutting it down, closing it off, isolating it from the rest of the world. Perhaps it involves a kind of way of being in relation to others in a different way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a concern of, I think, more contemporary, also me thinking about contemporary politics.
Right.
But I wonder if you would make that distinction between Plato's political ideology, maybe, and what we see Socrates performing in the dialogues.
Well, absolutely. The city that Plato constructs in the Republic or the Laws is not a city that would be easy for us to see ourselves in, I'm sure.
Right.
But the city that Socrates seems to inhabit is a different one, and I take your point there that the picture of Socrates is the picture of a man in a city that is more open to these challenges and hasn't constructed artificial barriers to them.
But I mean, this is an interesting idea that if what Plato is constructing is a kind of fantasy in the Laws, of a city that is in control of its desires, what is the erotic force of that idea? I mean, because there's a danger that you might think that we could sort of start over, as he tries to do, as Socrates tries to do in the Republic sometimes, of kind of, you know, okay, we've just got to cut off some people and start with the new generation because they've just learned these bad habits.
Right.
We can't, as human beings, just start over. I mean, one of the great things about your work is to show how these philosophical ideas are always within a kind of rich and complicated social, political, historical context. And that's where we find ourselves. It's not like we can just start over.
Right.
And is there a dangerous dimension to that fantasy of starting over?
Well, the starting over, when one looks at it, involves some pretty ruthless measures, as you alluded to, eliminating people and taking drastic action and basically raising a new generation.
Right.
A couple of things that I find remarkable about that concept as Plato envisions it. On the one hand, there's some surprising resonances, even in as late as the Laws, with the Periclean rhetoric, because one of the things that the Laws should do, I think this is in Book One of the Laws, is to make the young become arastai of becoming good citizens. So the notion that the motive to becoming fulfilling your civic duties in an appropriate way is again an erotic image, and it's found there in the Laws. And when Plato begins to square with this question of how actually to bring such a thing about, he once again raises the figure of the enlightened tyrant, actually a tyrannos aner, who should have some kind of, I think there's a divine element he should have, which is a sort of magic wand to make him good instead of bad. But the tyrant is the person who has the greatest eros, and this divinely guided tyrant should have eros for the good, and he is the one who has the energy and the drive and the force to make it happen. So Plato has to once again revive this image of a figure of unbridled force, power, and desire in order to bring about what he envisions as the ultimate good.
Right. I mean, and I think that's one of the concerns that I think I have about that sort of strategy that might be being performed in the Laws, which is, first, the one side is what is the dangerous erotic draw of that idea that we could start over. But the other point I think that I would want to think about is the way in which the appeal to the divine inspiration is always somewhat problematic, and something that I think, you know, Socrates himself in the dialogues does appeal to a certain kind of divine inspiration, but it's always this daimon who's telling him not to do things when he's doing something wrong. And so it's always rooted in a specific kind of context, and it's never permitted to be an appeal to an objective absolute outside of the context in which he's living. And so that's where I feel like the question, the interesting dynamic that's happening in Socratic politics in the dialogues is his attempt to articulate a kind of account of the good, or to get us to consider that question, what is the good, without necessarily appealing to this absolute external principle that is maybe possessible. That I think that, that sensitivity to a certain finitude and humility that you get in Socratic politics, which I think you miss sometimes, certainly in some of the sophists who are caricatured in some of the dialogues.
Well, that may be a feature, again, of what I would suspect is the character of late 5th century Athens, which is going to be rather different in terms of public discourse than Athens of a generation later, where you do have politicians like Hyperbolus, demagogues, or orators like Gorgias, who explicitly dangle in front of audiences what they claim to be images of the desirable, and so it's a the public appeal of this is manifest everywhere, and it only takes a sharp critic like Socrates to begin to call this into question, but he's able to do that simply because such exaggerated examples, I think, of this pursuit are present around him in a way that Plato later has to sort of revive through the dialogues in order to relive those dramatic moments when a character like Gorgias is in conversation with Socrates. Those themes are more attenuated in public discourse a century later.
But I mean, it does bring up the interesting question of what is the relationship between Eros and this kind of, and the question of hubris. And so one, I have the sense that Socrates implicitly thinks that a healthy attitude toward Eros, toward this erotic side of, or that which animates human being in relation to one another, is humble in a certain way. That to have a healthy relationship, there is a certain kind of boldness that you need to press forward, and courage that he has to continue conversations when we're at a loss. And it's all bound up in this, you know, agonistic and sort of honor-based structure, but there's still a sense, and I think that even goes all the way back to Homer, this notion of hubris and what happens when somebody doesn't realize that they're not God, they're not a god. So I mean, I really wonder about the relationship between humility, certain humility, and Eros.
Yes, well, there's something about an imperial democracy, a democracy that is sovereign and defending its sovereignty fiercely, that is immodest. And Athens, and this is, of course, a critique that we hear leveled by Thucydides and others of the politicians of the age, especially after Pericles, that they were competing in immodesty, in the sense that they were egging the Athenians on ever more in order to win approval for themselves and their programs. But to capture the attention of the crowd, to make themselves to prostitute themselves as ever more erotic objects, and that leads to a kind of gross distortion, an immodesty, which is, I think, what we see Socrates reacting against.
And I think, in that sense, Socrates then does serve as a kind of model for the role of philosophy in that kind of context. Yeah. So that philosophy's role in a certain sense is to say, hold on, what is the conception of the good that you're operating with?
Right.
Is this from the perspective, from a broader perspective of the whole, as much as one can get a grasp of it, the really the good that we should be aiming for, or do we need to reconsider our account of the good? So I think that, you know, in that sense, that's for me what's so powerful about the figure, the dramatic figure of Socrates in these contexts, is that he provides a model for what philosophers could be doing, even in a contemporary political, social political context, saying, okay, mm-hmm. wait a minute, you know, is this the direction that we should be going and moving?
Right. But let me ask you a question here, too. Is this a model, do you think, that Socrates thinks, you say a model for philosophy in a city? Is it a model for politics in a city?
Yeah.
And that's...
Well, I mean, I think what I think for... I think Socrates believed it was a model for citizens to follow, in the sense that the question that he tries to get all of the people he meets to think about is,
right.
what is the nature of this good that you're desiring?
Right.
And so I would want to make a distinction. I think Socrates thinks he's doing politics when he's engaged with, you know, even Euthyphro and with even these individuals that he's participating in. He says in the Gorgias, I'm the only one who's practicing the true art mm-hmm. of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he means something like that. He doesn't go to the assembly and try to, you know, influence mm-hmm. the decisions there. He explicitly says, I don't do that.
Right.
So he means, when he's talking about politics, he has that, I think, that interhuman dynamic in mind.
Well, certainly, we as teachers have to have that
right.
hope that we're able to influence politics through the individual influence that we have on our students. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, in fact, in some ways, and maybe this is the note to end on, in some ways that's part of what's animated this project, and even as animated the attempt to put it out online and in podcasts and things, is to say, you know, first of all, modeling, you know, dialogical conversations that are not agonistic is an important thing to have. And
mm-hmm.
second of all, that if we can have influence on students and on one another to turn our questioning to and to cultivate those habits that help us question and ask about what the good is, what the beautiful might be for us, that could have a potentially very powerful political implication. It
mm-hmm.
won't involve any of us, I think, taking power, running for president,
yeah.
but it will slowly over time in our classrooms and elsewhere have a real impact on.
And in relation to my project, I should say that I'm not primarily a Platonic or Socratic scholar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a historian interested in understanding the context in which these
right.
ideas are played out, so that one can see the tensions that
right.
are gripping the public imagination and in the immediate background of all of Socrates' interlocutors' minds
right.
when this is all taking place.
Well, and that's why, from my perspective, your work is so important to those of us who are doing the work in the, let's say, strictly so-called philosophical realm, and I think it's nice that we don't necessarily need to divide the disciplines up so rigidly, but it really is helpful to have the work that you have to give us the context that we need to understand those texts, if we take seriously this notion that philosophy is always done in a context, and we have to know that context. So thank you so much for joining me on the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks so much, Chris. Great pleasure.